versus Hopewell, 12-2851. Ms. Lennon?
Good morning, Your Honors. Officers arrested Mr. Hopewell without probable cause. Any evidence obtained as a result of this illegal arrest must be suppressed. The first step in the court's analysis is determining whether what occurred on the bus was in fact an arrest requiring probable cause or a Terry stop. This is a fact-specific inquiry, and admittedly, in some cases, the line between the two is blurry. Here, though, the facts support a finding that officers crossed the line and performed a full-fledged arrest on Mr. Hopewell. This becomes clear when you look at the officers' actions as compared to Mr. Hopewell's. The amount of restraint employed by the officers was not reasonable in light of Mr. Hopewell's actions. To take a look first at the officers' actions. The officers emptied the bus, got on the bus, three officers got on the bus, and at gunpoint ordered Mr. Hopewell, who was seated in the back of the bus, to drop his backpack, to move to the front of the bus. All of this took place at gunpoint, to lay down on the floor of the front of the bus, where they handcuffed him behind his back, still at gunpoint, and then they led him off the bus and into the back of a squad car, where they Mirandized him and began questioning him. So those are the officers' actions. Now, to take a look at Mr. Hopewell's actions, he was sleeping when the officers got on the bus. He was the only one on the bus at the time, and he was asleep. He wasn't presenting any sort of threat at the time. He complied with all of the officers' commands. As soon as they ordered him to do something, he did it. He got on the floor of the bus. He allowed himself to be handcuffed. At no time did he make any furtive movements. He didn't attempt to flee at any time.
Are we supposed to ignore sort of what happened before that, that they got this notice on a 911 caller that someone had a loaded gun that was pointed at him by a mail bus passenger who placed the gun into the red backpack? What are we to do with that?
Well, of course it shouldn't be ignored, Your Honor. It factors into whether there was probable cause to perform this arrest. Our position is that you first need to determine whether it was an arrest or a Terry stop. And yes, the information provided in the call does factor into that to an extent. But just the presence of a gun doesn't make it okay to take this level of action against Mr. Hopewell. You need to compare the officer's actions, including the information that they got in the tip, to what they did to Mr. Hopewell and what Mr. Hopewell was doing at the time, which...
The caller also identified the bus route and the number and said the man had fallen asleep.
And described this guy to a T. I mean, this was an extraordinarily detailed tip.
That's true, Your Honor. And to sort of segue into the probable cause analysis a little bit and discuss the tip in further detail, there were two types of information provided in the tip. The things that Your Honors just identified are the physical description of Mr. Hopewell. And yes, it's true, but anyone riding the bus that day could have described him in the same way. This was not something...
I don't understand that argument.
It was a physical description.
Not just a physical description of what this guy looked like, but what he did. He took out a loaded gun and aimed it at somebody. That calls for a pretty substantial response from the cops.
A pretty substantial response, yes.
And in fact, perhaps an arrest, if that's what this is. I have a more threshold kind of question. What difference does it make to the legality of the frisk of the backpack, which turned up the gun? Does it make any difference whether this was a Terry stop or an arrest to legitimate that?
When we're dealing with the search of the backpack itself, I think it does make a difference. Because if the court finds probable cause, which we think there's no probable cause here, but if the court finds probable cause and this was an arrest, if the government's argument is that the backpack could be searched as a search incident to arrest or under the automobile exception, where our argument is that neither of those exceptions apply, but that is the government's argument.
Well, the search incident to arrest argument, obviously, that doctrine applies if it's an arrest. If it's a Terry stop, you know, they can frisk the bag to secure their own safety while they're securing him, and that's how I understand the factual record here.
Correct. So the distinction between the arrest versus the Terry stop, your original question, I'd like to get back to you for just a moment because I think it's important. So the search incident to arrest, yes, they could do if it was a legitimate arrest supported by probable cause. It wasn't. But under a Terry stop, there's no search incident to arrest analogy in the Terry stop context. It would have to be a frisk, as Your Honor just said. And what the officers did here wasn't a frisk of the backpack. And I'd like to step back for a moment, too. It's our position that the officers should not have even been frisking the backpack because at the time, any exigency associated with the backpack or any problems associated with the backpack had been removed when Mr. Hopewell was removed from the situation.
It's not an exigent circumstances kind of case. It's just when the officers do a Terry frisk, you know, whether it's on the bus or on the street, they're entitled to secure the suspect, and that includes,
correct,
you know, whatever he's holding.
But a frisk is a pat-down frisk. It's not a pick up the backpack, unzip it, look inside, search. It's a frisk, and that's not what happened here.
Except the officer testified that he feared that the revolver could be cocked, and if it was equipped with a light trigger, it could easily fire. So that was part of the rationale.
The rationale that the district court used was exigency, yes. But our problem with that is that the exigency that the officer identified is just far too speculative, far too vague, and it assumes that some of the information the caller provided was correct, number one. But then it also, I'd like to go through it for a second just to show you how speculative it was.
Well, even if we give you that, there weren't exigent circumstances, I don't see how you get out of there was not probable cause, given the detailed information by the caller. And when the police officers arrived, everything that the caller said was this guy, your guy.
It was the physical description. It wasn't any corroboration of the illegality. The backpack is just something that was a aspect of the physical description. It was an article, essentially, of clothing.
Yeah, you said that's where he put the gun?
Mm-hmm.
Correct. But
it isn't just an article of description. It's a very specific thing. The gun was placed inside the backpack.
But it would be the same as if the gun was placed in somebody's pants. So it's still a physical description, though.
Yeah.
So it would be, to make it more concrete, anybody sitting in the back of the courtroom right now could leave the courtroom, call the police, just provide a physical description of me, say that in 10 minutes I'd probably still be in this courtroom, and I have a gun in my briefcase, which obviously I don't.
Can we check that?
Sure, Your Honor. But that's what they were working with here. That's what they arrested him on. So if somebody walked out of the courtroom and did that, provided a name, sure. Who knows if the name was the correct name, their correct name, and then said that I had a gun in my backpack, the officers could put me on the ground, handcuff me, drag me out of the courtroom, and put me in a squad car and question me. That's troublesome. And that's what they were working with here. There was no way to corroborate the assertion of illegality, the gun, in the backpack. The only thing they corroborated was the information that anyone could observe. Anybody in the courtroom could observe it about me. Anybody on the bus that day could have observed it about Mr. Hopewell. That's troublesome, and that doesn't amount to probable cause.
So you're saying that what the police officers needed was perhaps when they got on the bus, he was waving the gun? Would that be... I guess he'd have to have the gun out or something.
Perhaps. I mean, I could think of...
You've got about a minute left for your rebuttal, too.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to briefly answer your question, though, I think there are many circumstances that we could think about that would have corroborated or worked to corroborate what the caller said. He could have reached for the backpack, tried to flee. Evidence of flight sometimes adds to a probable cause analysis. But none of that happened. He was sleeping.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Altman. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the United States in this case. The purpose of the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule is to protect against unreasonable searches and seizures. In this case, the officers responded to a 911 call of a man pointing a loaded gun at the caller on a public bus. They responded and found the person described. There were other officers and other members of the public in the area. The officers made an on-scene determination, an assessment, and looked into the backpack the defendant had been holding prior to the search. Whether you come at it through probable cause or through reasonable suspicion or through exigent circumstances, everything the officers did, their actions were entirely reasonable, and the gun should not be suppressed. Looking first at the probable cause aspect of it, there was a caller to 911. He gave more than his name. He gave his first name. He gave his last name. He said where he worked. He said that he was at work. He provided a phone number where he could be reached. And he said the bus had cameras on it, so it should be easy to find the defendant and see what had happened. Someone who is making up information or just calling in a call to do this isn't going to say, look at the cameras and see what happened. The caller said how he knew about the gun. He said that the defendant had pointed the gun at him and then put it back into the backpack, so they knew where the gun was. He said it was a silver revolver. It had hollow point bullets. And when officers receive information from an eyewitness or a victim that essentially establishes the elements of the crime, it's almost always sufficient to establish probable cause, and that's what we have here.
Did he say how he knew it had hollow point bullets?
I believe he did. I think he said he recognized it as hollow point bullets because he'd seen them before.
How can he see the bullets inside the gun?
The person pulled it out and showed it to him and then put it back into the gun and loaded it. That was part of the call.
Okay, so the transcript of the 911 call describes the defendant actually loading the gun in front of this witness?
I believe so. I have the transcript. I can double check on that. Not of the 911 call, but of the hearing. But I believe that there was testimony that he pulled the hollow point bullet out, showed it to him, and put it back in the gun. And again, I have a transcript of the hearing here.
That's just in the transcript from the hearing or was part of the 911 call?
Well, if it was part of the transcript at the hearing, then the officers knew it because that was what they were going on at the time.
Well, they knew it was a revolver. I just don't remember from having reviewed the transcript that there was testimony about this loading.
They knew it was a hollow point bullet.
Okay.
So if and I know that they knew that, so then they did know that he had pulled it out and showed it to them.
Okay.
It was a 911 call, so again, there's a greater reliability than any sort of just anonymous tip or phone call to a tip line, and it was an immediate response. So,
just to get the chronology down, after the officers arrived in the bus, the initially responding officer gets the defendant secured on the floor of the bus, and then the second officer who actually conducted the search of the bag comes in at that point while the defendant's still on the bus?
It was a little unclear. It was, I believe the officer who searched the bag said it was almost simultaneous.
Okay.
There could have been some testimony from the officer who was taking him off the bus, that he was towards the front of the bus. He may have been a few feet from the backpack.
So he's not actually in the squad car at the time that the search is conducted. This is all kind of moving rapidly.
Correct. It was a very fluid situation as it was occurring. As Your Honors have already alluded to, everything that the informant said was corroborated by what the officers found. Both the magistrate judge and the district court judge said that they didn't find probable cause because it was an uncorroborated tip, and the government believes that's incorrect. It was corroborated in every single way it could possibly be corroborated at the time, where the bus was, who was on the bus, the number of the bus, the location of the bus, the the way that the defendant was dressed, what he was holding, and even down to the fact that the defendant was actually asleep. All of those things were reported, and that's what the officers saw when they responded.
So this goes on, this goes beyond the situation where there's just a physical description and the suspect meets the physical description. There's some predictive information here that gives the anonymous tip greater reliability under that particular doctrine?
As much predictive ability as there can be in this type of situation. Obviously, the caller couldn't predict what this exact defendant was going to do, but he could say where the bus was going to go and what bus it was. He provided every single bit of information he possibly could for the officers to rely on.
Let's say it's a Terry stop instead of an arrest. What difference does that make for purposes of the legality of the search?
Well, then the officers couldn't search an incident to arrest, clearly, the backpack. The backpack, though, they could still look into. I know Your Honor said it wasn't an exigent circumstances case, but to some extent it was, because the officers believed that in that bag was a revolver, which is particularly dangerous, and this is an officer who was a firearms instructor, with a hollow point bullet. And that if the bag got bumped while it was going off the bus, it could go off. And there were people in the area. There were officers in the area. It was a public bus transfer point. And so they still had he said he wasn't going to frisk the backpack because that would put him in more danger. And rather than doing that, he looked in the backpack to find out whether or not the gun was in there. So if you go at it that way, that's the analysis that
would
be
used. The exigent circumstances doctrine really applies in a different context, which is to say when the argument that's being made is that we didn't have time to get a warrant. We don't have a timing issue here. We have a different sort of a circumstance, which is
a danger issue.
A danger issue, and that's usually the frisk analysis. And the wrinkle here is that this wasn't a frisk of the bag in the sense of a pat-down of the bag, but the officer explained why he wasn't going to conduct the search that way. He was going to conduct it by looking in the bag, because if he did a pat-down of the bag, he might set the weapon off.
Exactly.
So it's just a question of, you know, what sort of a search is justifiable in the context of the Terry doctrine. And, you know, when you're talking about the frisk of a person, there are some limitations on that because of the expectation of privacy on your person, but under these circumstances where the course of conduct is that there's a loaded gun with hollow point bullets and it's a revolver in this backpack, that it's hardly unreasonable for the officer not to pat it down and to opt for a look inside instead.
That would certainly be my position, Your Honor. And if the court has no further questions, I would simply ask the court to affirm the district court's conviction.
All right. You've got 1 minute.
There are two things that I'd just like to briefly discuss. The first is to touch on the exigency issue. This was not a bomb, and there is no evidence that the officers knew that the gun had hollow point bullets in it. And the fact of the matter is that somebody shouldn't be searched or have their articles searched just because there's some uncorroborated tip that they might have a gun in the backpack. The officers didn't know that was true when they got on scene. And then just briefly, I'd like to touch on the ongoing emergency 911 call argument made by the government. The caller was at work when he made the call. So he had gotten off the bus, a period of time had lapsed, then he made the call. He wasn't observing real-time events or anything like that. And so that makes it more in the realm of a report of general criminality versus report of an ongoing emergency that would lend reliability to the situation.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement, and court will stand in recess till tomorrow at 9:30.